Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Ryan Bennett, an Aussie Canuck living in the Central Coast, Australia. And you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome, folks, to the Tennis Podcast, introduced this week by, as you heard there, Ryan Bennett, an Aussie Canuck in Australia. Is he Australian? Is he Canadian? Who can say? Apparently not even Ryan, but those are two excellent countries, both tennis hosting countries. I visited them both on several occasions and enjoyed them both very much indeed. David, how are you doing?
I'm very much okay because Solihull has decided to give us just a little bit of sunshine just for the back end of can I call it even summer? I can't really. It's autumn now, isn't it? It's fall, as the Americans like to say. So I'm all right. Thank you.
Matt, how are we doing?
Very well, thank you. Yep, at my seaside retreat this weekend, also known as my parents'. And it's been lovely here too.
We, after 12 long days, folks, have finally reached the end of the ATP Masters 1000 event in Shanghai. And that also means that we are finally back into a normal ATP timetable in terms of tournaments starting at the beginning of the week and ending at the end of the week. And can I have an alleluia for that, please? Because I at no point in the last month of that situation did I ever really get a handle on it. Full disclosure, I never really got a handle on Shanghai, on the cadence of that tournament, on what matches were happening when, on what stage of the event we were at. And, you know, as seems to happen with these extended 1000 events, it's 12 days long. That seems to be long enough for a nicely paced schedule, and yet suddenly at the end of the tournament you end up with players playing 3 days in a row and you're like, no, what are we doing here, tennis? I've had a lot of what are we doing here tennis moments over the last 12 days, but I know that David and Matt, you feel rather more positively about Shanghai because you're both morning tennis watchers. I think a lot of my grumpiness comes from the fact that I don't like mornings. I like to watch my tennis in the evenings. I'd rather stay up and watch in the middle of the night than have it be happening at 7 a.m, quite frankly. But don't worry, folks. We've got it covered because David Law doesn't sleep.
I certainly sleep at different hours to you most of the time. I was okay with it, actually, even though it was all a bit strange with the Beijing women's tournament and several of the others finishing midweek, which is really strange to what we're used to. But it was kind of useful for week one of Shanghai when you'd got more going on. And you'd got a bit of action in the middle of the week while Shanghai sort of plod into some sort of momentum. And I actually quite enjoyed Shanghai, as you say, because I get the kids off to school, start work, and I could put it on, and I'd got it as company all day long, and there were lots of quite good matches, particularly early on. I quite enjoyed quite a lot of the tennis. I think it's a good visual experience to watch it. The colours of the court are good. You know, it's obviously, it hasn't been there for 4 years, so it's a big deal in that regard. When they got to the quarterfinals and played 4 quarterfinals over 2 days, and you didn't have, it was the first time we'd had a non-combined event played over this length of time. I just thought, come on, this really added to the what you've just said about 3 matches in 3 days at the end. That just really highlights a drawback of that system. It was plodding along, and I'm sorry, it's just not big enough to my mind to warrant that sort of separation.
Matt, similar feelings?
Yeah, very similar. It was what I feared would happen. You know, it's always quite difficult to know what a tournament will look like when it's being played in this way for the first time. But in my mind, it was exactly like this, and that is what happened. Just you know, days where you've only got just a couple of matches on court, and that's not what these weeks are about. You know, for me anyway, it should be about the buzz, and you know, there's always a good match on, you know, no matter where you look. You know, we had WTA events on this week as well, so I would sometimes sort of hop over and watch those. You know, that there were other options, but it just didn't have the right feel for an event of this size. As you said, it just sort of plodded along. There were some good matches which I enjoyed. Like David, I quite like getting the tennis on in the morning and having it on in the background when I'm doing some other work. But yeah, not a vintage Masters 1000, I don't think.
Yeah, sorry, Hubert Hurkacz, the champion that we're now going to heap praise on. You have won a non-vintage ATP Masters 1000 event. Congratulations to you. The other one he won was non-vintage as well, wasn't it? It was a very pandemic-y Miami Open. But I'll hit you with the cliche. Let that take nothing away from Hubert Hurkacz, who is the champion. He beat Andrei Rublev, who'd played some incredible tennis over the course of the 12 days. 6-3, 3-6, 7-6 in the final. As I say, his second Masters 1000 title, en route to it. He beat Zheng Zhizhen, who brought a lot of the vibes this week, I would say. Having a male Chinese player playing well at that tournament was really helpful. Fabian Marajan is apparently potentially back. And he beat Sebastian Korda as well. Those wins all since we last recorded a week ago. We'll get on to some other results and stories from the week, but let's just stay with Hurkacz for a moment. Is this the best you've both ever seen Hubert Hurkacz play? And did we learn anything new about Hubert Hurkacz this week, David?
I can't say that it is the best I've seen him play. I think it's probably the joint best I've seen him play. I think he did do incredibly well when he won that pandemic key Masters 1000 a couple of years
and
ago.
And he taketh away.
I think actually at times this year he's put together some really good performances, either to be competitive with Djokovic at Wimbledon for when he should have really won two sets in that match. And yeah, he has got an incredible serve as a basic weapon to his game, a basic foundation. And he backs it up with a really good ground game and superb movement for somebody of his size. I think that what I would say about this is I was really impressed that he fought his way to this title. You know, he won two of those matches over three sets against Zheng, who's got the whole crowd behind him and who's got the vibe, as you say. There was a moment in that final set tiebreak, I think he was 4-3 up Hurkacz, and Arvin Palmer and Nick Lester were in commentary, and they just said, who do you think's going to win this at that point? And both of them said Hurkacz. It was kind of, and that was what I thought at the time, kind of just the experience is going to pay off here. And it feels like, and he didn't lose another point in the tiebreak. And it just, Zhang has got all this pizzazz and he's exciting to watch. But Hurkacz is quite good in those moments. You know, he fights a lot of three-set matches, way too many, in my opinion. The same happened against Marijan. He's the opponent feels like the story in the moment. They are inducing the gasps from the crowd, and they're the ones making me want to go and watch it. I do not seek out Hubert Hurkacz matches to go and watch unless he's at the tail end of tournaments like this, or unless he's playing somebody else good. I know that sounds, people will say, oh, you're so mean. I don't care. That's how he makes me feel. I don't get massively enthused watching him play. But I am impressed with him. And when we got into the match against Korda, who's a similar build to him and a similar type of player, he routinely beat Seb Korda. And that was impressive. And then he's playing Rublev, who's, I think he has played some of the best tennis I've ever seen him play over the last week. And he had a match point, he had a championship point, Rublev, but Hurkacz hung on and won that match and won that title and totally deserved it. I just feel for the next level, he needs to stop having so many long matches. He should be routinely beating a lot more people the way he did with Seb Korda in that semi-final. So I don't feel like I've seen anything massively new, but at the same time, I did feel very impressed.
Yeah, it's a similar conversation with Hurkacz, I think, to the one we had the other week about the sort of Zverev-Nishikori scale. You know, how much is it impressive that they're winning these matches in three sets versus how much should they actually be trying to close these matches out sort of more straightforwardly and routinely? And I think inevitably I do fall on the side of, yes, it's impressive the way they win so many tight matches, but Hurkacz is too good, I think, to be getting himself involved in all of these sorts of classics that David's describing. But yeah, he was very much in his element in that final when it went to a final set tiebreak, because he just plays so many of them, and it did develop into a bit of a thriller towards the end, with, you know, both having match points and both saving them. And I think the Hurkacz serve is an incredible weapon. They brought up a graphic on the screen after the end of the first set in that final where every single one of his first serves had been in what you would describe as the corner of the box. You know, not a single one had been in the middle area. So Rublev just couldn't get his racket on the ball. As soon as that dropped off in the second set and Rublev started to get himself into some rallies, it became a match that you felt like Rublev could win, because he was just hitting the ball brilliantly from the baseline all week. But when Hurkacz was finding that serve, it was very much on his racket. And yeah, look, I don't think I learned anything new about Hubert Hurkacz either. But it's a big deal for him to win this tournament. You know, I think he's reached the final of a Masters 1000 event 3 years in a row now. He's won a couple of them. Like, he's ticking the boxes at this level. The thing for Hubert Hurkacz is his Grand Slam record. And I don't mean to sort of beat him with that now, because it's not like there's a slam that he can just suddenly play. But overall, in the picture of his career, that's the element that is missing. I feel like we knew he could do this at Masters 1000 level, and it's great that he's won another one. You know, there's plenty of good players over the last few years who've only won one Masters 1000 title. To get two is impressive. But I think if we're going to be learning something new about Hurkacz over the next few years, it's going to have to come at the slams, because he's got a really disappointing record in those tournaments compared to just how good he can be on the tour.
Yeah, in terms of sort of learning something new about players, I didn't feel like that was the best I'd ever seen Hubert Hurkacz play. I feel like, he's an excellent player. We know that. I think about how he played against Carlos Alcaraz earlier this year in Cincinnati, I think. Could have been Canada. I think it was Cincinnati. Probably should have won that match. But I do think he perhaps deep down has a bit of an imposter syndrome against the very top players. While he is excellent in the tight matches against players that are his peers or lower, because he's able to deploy that, the muscle memory and the experience of being in so many tight matches. Conversely, against the very, very top players. Djokovic at Wimbledon, those tie breaks. Alcaraz in Cincinnati. There are other examples as well. I feel like it goes the other way and something is just missing. You don't back him in those moments. But in terms of quality of tennis, I think we've known that he's capable of this for a while, and it's good to see him producing it. But as you say, Matt, the test is going to be at the Grand Slams. Conversely, though, I do think this is the best that I've ever seen Andrei Rublev play. I don't know if that means anything in terms of changing the course of his career, because I think he needs variety to be more of a challenge at the biggest events, at the majors. There is a reason why he is butted up against this quarterfinal glass ceiling, and it's not because his baseline game isn't excellent when it's on. It's because people can, you know, the best in the world can find the keys to unlock that, and he's got nothing else to rely on. So I don't know if it means anything. You two can tell me different, but this is the best I've ever seen him play his game.
Well, he didn't lose a set until that final. So that's 8 out of 8. And he's beaten good players along the way. You know, it was a really close first set against Dimitrov. He absolutely thrashed Hugo Humbert, who'd beaten him the week before. There was just a real conviction about the way he was striking the ball. Now, I mean, there often is, but it felt like he knew what he was doing with it. He imposed his sort of whiplash and on the rise ground strokes more than normal. And I also felt for the vast majority of the tournament, he controlled himself really well. I thought we saw another great benefit of the courtside coaching from a player perspective and also from a viewer's perspective, in that we heard what was being said to him. And I found it really insightful and enlightening to me as to what he's going through in the moment. There was a moment, I think he was playing Dimitrov. It's tie break. He's already served for the set. It's 2 points all in the tie break. He turns around and it's Alberto Martin, the former player who's in his box, who's sharing coaching duties these days with Fernando Vicente. And Rublev just goes, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And this is just two points all in the tie break. It's not like it's going horribly wrong on the scoreboard, but that's what's in his head. And Martin goes, don't think, just believe. And I just thought, this guy is so calm in the way he's delivering very short messages that are trying to stop Rublev tying himself up in knots, and just not worry about how you're going to do it. Just assume that it's going to be okay, because you've got the game, and his game is so muscle memory based. I don't think anybody hits the ball in quite the way that Rublev does. The way he refuses to back off, and he just, you know, I still think it has limits and a ceiling, but he doesn't need to worry too much, is what Martin's trying to get to him. And just to, because what ends up happening is he almost beats himself because he gets so upset. I feel terribly for Rublev, what he's going through on the court. I also then hate to see what he ends up doing. I mean, he went ranted at a bunch of photographers on the court side in the final. When he lost, he had a championship point in this match. When he lost the match, he absolutely started smashing himself in the leg again with the frame of the racket. I hate seeing it. But I do feel like Alberto Martin has got the right way of dealing with him and helping him, because how a guy goes, and we've seen it with lots and lots of players, Murray's an example, John McEnroe, people who go from being totally different personalities off the court to who they are in the moment. And I, whilst, again, Rublev is not a player I absolutely love to watch on his own right, I enjoy watching matches he's involved in, but I also hope the best for him. I kind of hope it happens for him increasingly, just for him, because he seems like such a great bloke off the court. He puts in so much effort. I mean, I think it probably plays too much, all the rest of the things that we say about many players, but just as a human being, I hope that he keeps having success in the future for him.
So in conclusion, Riyadh 2 finalists, we're very happy for you as people, but it doesn't mean anything.
And I know they have their fans, and that's great, but they're not my favourites to watch as tennis players. They're just not. But I actually think as blokes, I'd probably like them because they seem like nice fellas.
Well, the good news, David, is that we do have one of your favourites to talk about. Grigor Dimitrov he did enough in Shanghai to force himself into the agenda. If only the listeners could see David's little face right now. Grigor Dimitrov has only gone and beaten the famous Carlos Alcaraz and Nicholas Jarry all in 1 week, and Alexander Vukic and Karen Khachanov. Ended up losing out in the semi-final stages.
Yeah, to Rublev.
But David, before that, I mean, it's classic Dimitrov, isn't he? He was looking brilliant until he wasn't. but he really, it was lovely for him, wasn't it? Seeing him beat Carlos. I mean, not lovely to see Carlos Alcaraz lose, but that meant a lot to him, that win, beating Carlos Alcaraz, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it did. And I think it didn't just in isolation, because I think he believes that it's part of the direction that he's going. Yes, he didn't end up winning the title, but you know, he was edged out by a guy playing, as we've said, probably the best tennis we've seen him play. I do think there's a bit of a question mark over the way Dimitrov's fading later in matches, if it gets really grueling. We saw it against Zverev at the US Open, where he played brilliantly for a couple of sets and then faded. Some of these guys seem to be able to outlast him when it gets really physical. I mean, he is 32 now. Maybe that's becoming a factor. But I just feel like if you go back to when he started working with Jaime Delgado, and he's working as well with Dani Valverde, and they've really got him buying into this use of the slice backhand. I don't think I've ever seen Dimitrov look as clear in his mind about what his game is. I think for years, the variety at his disposal, the abilities he's got, have just ended up confusing him. And he's never really found a way to package it all to get the very best out of himself. He's had wonderful moments, semi-finals at several of the Grand Slams, winning the ATP finals. But now, using that slice, it feels like this safety net, or he can always go back to that and rely on it to keep him in rallies, a bit like Dan Evans does in his matches, and then use the forehand and use the serve and use the movement to attack with. So I actually think I kind of felt like at the time that would probably be an instant win for him 6 months ago. And Delgado said, this is going to take some time. You know, this is not an overnight thing. And I just feel like next year, Dimitrov might actually be a factor again and beat some top players again, and maybe even have some results that really surprise you over the next 12
months. So vague.
Yeah.
So vague, David. Deliberately vague.
Well, yeah, because I think there are big question marks over the way he fades, and also obviously the nerve in the biggest moments, because some players have got more of that and shown more of that than he has. But I think he's doing everything right at the moment.
What I would say on Dimitrov is it always feels like a couple of different ways you can judge a player. You can judge someone on who they're beating. Like, are they actually able to beat the very, very top players? And I think my answer to that for Dimitrov over the last few years has been no. Like, and therefore, you know, that's why he hasn't won a title in, 6 years? Because there's always seems to be someone in the draw who he just can't beat. He doesn't quite have that very, very top level. But, you know, he had that this week in the way that he beat Carlos Alcaraz. He was absolutely brilliant. So that did feel like a sort of progression. But what he's not been doing all year, which is really impressive, is he's not been taking bad losses at all. Like, if you look at all the players he's lost to this year, they're basically just a sort of who's who of the best players in the world, really. And I think that's just given a sort of overall picture of a really, really healthy form that he's been in. He's been really good all year. He just hasn't quite been able to sort of elevate. But he did elevate in Shanghai to beat Alcaraz. And then, as you said, and this is you know, not me just saying this. This is not a bit. It was impressive that he then backed up that win over Alcaraz with the win over Jarry, because that was exactly the sort of match where you thought, okay, you've beaten Dimitrov, but you know, can you now
see
beat
if you
Jarry?
Can beat Jarry?
Yeah, it's just a sort of match that I think we all would have expected him to lose, and he was brilliant in that. The way he came through it, his spot serving, his placement on the serve is fantastic at the moment. That's, again, feels like something that's got a bit better this year. And he hasn't taken a bad loss there. He's lost to Rublev playing really, really well. So if he can maintain that consistency that he's found this year and bring some of the sparkle that he found against Alcaraz as well, David's right. I think he could be very, very dangerous this year. I just don't trust it to last, I suppose, is probably the feeling I have.
Just very quickly on Alcaraz, what do we make of his post US Open form? He had that semi-final loss to Jannik Sinner last week or the week before, or in another era, whenever it was in Beijing. He'd beaten good players before that. He'd beaten Musetti and Casper Ruud, Yannick Hanfmann. This week in Shanghai, the round of 16, lost to Grigor Dimitrov after beating Gregoire Barrère and Dan Evans in another just glorious match. Alcaraz and Evans matches are so much fun. Is Alcaraz just going to be a player that is going to have these kinds of losses? He's a looser, more risk-taking player than other players at the very, very top of the game. Is he going to just be more prone to slightly surprise losses than other very, very top players, particularly at events that, all due respect to this one, don't mean as much, where he can't find that extra 5% in your gut to make you put everything on the line?
I don't know. My take on this week was actually that maybe he was putting a bit too much pressure on himself. He's been talking about really wanting to get back to world number one and finish the year as world number one. And I think he saw the tournaments in China, Beijing and Shanghai over the last couple of weeks as a big opportunity to make up some ground on Novak Djokovic, who's obviously not playing. And to me, there seemed to be a slight tightness to him in the last couple of tournaments. And I think that's when he gets error-strewn. That's when the unforced errors just pile up and he can maybe get in his own head a little bit. I think he was pretty honest about that after losing to Sinner, to say that after we lost that first set, he just got a bit stressed and just started going for it in the second set and didn't quite have his game, and it all sort of tailed off and ran away from him. And it wasn't quite like that against Dimitrov. It was very close, but he seemed a bit stressed to me, you know, and I think when he's at his best, he's actually quite relaxed. And I don't think we quite saw relaxed, sort of not carefree, that's the wrong word, but just controlled Alcaraz over the last couple of weeks. We've seen him spraying the ball, and I think he does that when he's tight. And I think at the moment I put this down to he's still, as great as he is, he's still learning, and he's still so young and inexperienced, and I'm not that worried about Alcaraz at all. I just think it's just a sort of natural process that a 20-year-old, even a great one, sort of has to go through. But it will be something to keep an eye on, whether he can sort of find a way to not feel like this on court and get a little bit more consistent, because yes, it has been an inconsistent spell since Wimbledon, really, I would say.
That was such a polite way of saying, no, Catherine, it's the exact opposite of what you're suggesting.
It's only a theory.
It's a really good theory. It's a way better theory than one
I think it's a really good question, though, as well, because that is often a thing for players.
I think what I was thinking of is, you know, not that in his very, you know, dominant peak, Federer suffered many losses at all, but Federer is just so much of a looser player than Novak Djokovic, for example. You know, he's got a far worse break point conversion and far worse losing from match point up record than somebody like Novak Djokovic, who can just go into lockdown mode. That's just never going to be Alcaraz. Well, he's always the one to point out, isn't he? I think of myself like Roger Federer, not like Rafael Nadal or Novak Djokovic. But yeah, you're absolutely right about the looseness versus tightness thing. And I retract everything that I suggested might be the case a few minutes ago. Last couple of bits from Shanghai before we move on to the women's. Good to see Ben Shelton backing up his US Open form and reviving the hanging up the phone celebration. Big fan of that continuing to be a thing. Apparently Andy Murray in an interview last week was asked what his favourite celebration is in the sport, and he said the hanging up the phone thing that Ben Shelton does, so he's a fan. And I wondered if that was just a very, very subtle dig at Novak Djokovic as well, because he's been doing a few of those, hasn't he? He took a little pop on Instagram at Novak Djokovic. All very gentle stuff. But yeah, all in good fun.
Yeah, what was that in relation to now? Because I can't quite remember.
It was in relation to Djokovic's indignancy about taking body shots, I think.
Oh, yes, on the court, going directly at the body. And how annoyed he was about Cam Norrie.
Yes,
going at him at that time.
Yeah, sort of double stab, but you know, suggestion of hypocrisy from Andy Murray.
Right.
So yeah, good to see Shelton producing Grand Slam Shelton on the tour. Good to see Korda backing up his form from the previous weeks. They played a classic, didn't they? Korda beating Shelton 7-6. In the third, Shelton having beaten Sinner in the previous round in three sets. That was all very good fun. The doubles was won by Marcel Granoz and Horacio Zabias. They beat Matt Ebden and Rohan Bopanna in the final. Bopanna is back in the top five of the doubles rankings, aged 43, and for the first time since October 2013, which, I'll do the maths for you there, is a decade.
Amazing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or your smart TV, both in HD. Matt, this sounds like your kind of thing.
Yeah, there's nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere, dipping in to where there's the latest final set tiebreak or even the latest bit of aggro.
And David, don't worry, you can just watch your favourite court, Suzanne Longlen, all day if you want. But whatever you choose, the French Open promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history.
Do you know, I think in a lot of ways, the French Open is now my favourite slam. It's the strategy of the clay court tennis, the way it challenges players, and particularly now with legends of the game up against a new generation of young players. I cannot wait.
Be there when it happens, with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Subscribe to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TENNISPOD20 for 20% off your annual subscription. On to the WTA now, which starts in Zhengzhou, where the champion was Zhongxin Wen. She beat Barbora Krejcikova 2-6, 6-2, 6-4 to win her second title of the season. I'm hoping somebody else can talk about the tennis that she played, because all I can remember is the karaoke that she performed during the trophy ceremony. That is what is burned in my brain. That is what I'm taking from Zhongxin Wen this week. Before we come on to that, although not sure what else there is to say, the tennis, Matt, the tennis. She's very good, isn't she?
She is very good. And I think it wasn't that long ago that we were maybe having a few doubts about that, you know, where her serve was causing her some problems and her forehand technique looked a little bit wonky as well. But I must say, in the last 2 or 3 months or so, she's put together this really impressive run of form. And the last three players to have beaten her are Swiatek, Sabalenka and Rybakina. You know, it's taking the very best players in the world to beat Zhongxin Wen at the moment. She's won her last 14 against players ranked lower than her, which is just, you know, a sign of improved consistency, I think. In the final against Krejcikova, she got off to a slow start and had to turn it around. And that serve, which we've been a bit worried about, really came on strong in this match. Ended up with 10 aces, which was pretty impressive. And just some great hitting from both players in the final stage of that match. Really, really good win for her. And yeah, I mean, without wishing to sort of psychoanalyze her, without sort of knowing, I think a trait of a lot of elite athletes, and we've just mentioned Andy Murray there, is trying to prove people wrong, or, you know, playing with a little bit of a bit of a chip on your shoulder in sort of the best way possible. And I don't think we can ignore the fact that off the back of, you know, Wim Fossette leaving her team and going back to work with Naomi Osaka, and how honest Zhongxin Wen was about how sort of hurtful she found that. She's gone on to win, you know, the second title of her career, the biggest so far. She also just won the Asian Games as well, didn't she? So she's in a really good run of form since that announcement. And yeah, maybe playing with a little extra motivation, a little more something to prove, has sort of just fired her up a little bit more. And yeah, she was very, very impressive and has been for a little while now, which is good to see, because we were very excited about her a year or so ago, and it had been a slightly slower start to the season, but she's made big strides, and just excited to keep watching her, really.
Yeah, one of my tennis wishes for 2024 is Zhongxin Wen against Naomi Osaka, please, at the Australian Open.
Oh yes, have tell fun us about with this that, karaoke. Then.
She did karaoke during the trophy ceremony. And David, I'm not talking about a line or two. I'm not talking about who was it Djokovic in the US Open that did "You Gotta Fight for Your Right to Party"? I mean, that was too much. but it was still just, you know, a couple of lines. We got a whole song. It was quite something. It was, you know, St. Petersburg energy in terms of bizarreness. But I loved the uninhibitedness with which she did it. That was really nice to see. I mean, I was having an anxiety attack by proxy just watching her do that, but she was fine.
Yeah, it was very strange. I didn't really understand whether she was totally being forced into it, because she sort of gave her speech in English, then she gave her speech in Chinese, and then the music started playing, and she was sort of left on the middle of the stage, and it was almost like a, go on then, are you gonna sing along? And to start with, she didn't, but then she put her flowers down and really, really committed to it. And
it was very much, if I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna
do it properly.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. In Seoul, Jessica Pegula became the champion there, which is, as she told us on social media, a real life goal achieved for her. She won 6-2, 6-3 in the final over Yui Yuan. Jessica Pegula's mum is Korean, so Pegula herself half Korean. And as she reminded us in that same social media post after winning the title, her mum's birth parents left her on a street corner in front of a police station in Korea, and she was taken to an orphanage before being adopted age 5 and brought to the USA, which is a heck of a story. And Pegula said that when she played that tournament a few years ago, before her mum suffered the health issues that she struggled with in the last couple of years, her mum went and visited that orphanage that she spent the first few years of her life in. It's an extraordinary story, and I love that Jessica Pegula sort of led us into all of that a little bit, and what that title means to her. And you know, it's good, isn't it? We look from the outside and go, oh yeah, top 5 player wins a 250, big whoop, you know, give us a reason to care. And she's given us that, and it's a really nice little story.
Yeah, I was glad that she did that too, because I think at first glance, I kind of wonder why she'd entered that one as opposed to others. And yeah, I do love that. And it is a lovely story. And yeah, she keeps on coming as well, because I mean, the other thing with her is she just delivers so often when she's supposed to. We still know about the question marks over whether that will translate into these higher levels, but here's a tournament you're supposed to win, and she goes and wins it, including with that backstory. That's cool.
Yeah, really cool. And speaking of cool, in Hong Kong, Leila Fernandez won the title, her third career title. She beat Katerina Siniakova in a heck of a final, this, wasn't it, Matt? 3-6, 6-4, 6-4. One of the matches of the week, the final there.
Yeah, just a real thriller, actually. A real making a play for the intensity list, I think, this one. Because, yeah, as we often talk about, this sort of time in the calendar is sort of defined by that slight feeling of, what are we doing here? What does this all mean? And this was the perfect antidote to that, because they both just were bringing it. And Siniakova started the match with no legs taped and finished the match with both legs taped, having a medical timeout in the second set, which I think, you know, some people were a little bit suspicious of, because she was 4-love down when she took that medical timeout, came back with her leg taped and started roaring comeback and blazing winners. But there was an incredible 10-minute game that Fernandez came through, and that sort of sealed her that second set. And then a really nasty fall, actually, that Siniakova took in the third set after being wrong-footed. And then she ended up with her other leg taped. So it was really dramatic. They were both sort of breaking each other a lot. You really didn't know which way it was going to go. And in the end, it was just a reminder of the sort of matches that we just became so used to seeing Leila Fernandez play and win a couple of years ago, a sort of three-set thriller. And honestly, she's always been an incredible half volleyer, hasn't she? Just standing on the baseline, sort of refusing to budge. It feels like she's taken that to new heights. I mean, honestly, the way she was picking the ball up off her toes in this match was extraordinary. And Siniakova is so inconsistent, but at her best, just an incredible shot maker herself. And it was just a real thriller. And yeah, a great, great week for Fernandez. Beat Mira Andreeva, Linda Fruvertova, a couple of sort of players who were even younger than her. And yeah, her, her first title in a while, and sort of good, I think, to see that winning feeling be back. And I'll let David talk about how annoyed he was that as much as he likes Ada Fernandez, she did ruin his big prediction there.
Yes, David had picked Mira Andreeva very confidently in his newsletter predictions this week, having switched from Sebastian Korda at the last minute. And there was a day on which Korda had just beaten somebody good, and it felt like a genuine possibility that he could go on and win the title in Shanghai. Meanwhile, Mira Andreeva just lost to Leila Fernandez, and it looked like it was going to be a truly devastating week for David.
You looked happier
in the end, just
that
a normal
other
level of disappointment. I was all here for the Korda ending up winning that title.
Yes. Suddenly you became his biggest fan. Yeah. Yes, he just squeezed out Ben Shelton, and then fortunately Hubert Hurkacz rode to the rescue. I do really believe in Mira Andreeva's talent, probably to a ridiculous level, a bit like one or two of the other players, like Arta Fis, who I tend to go with regardless of who they're playing. And I was a bit miffed at Leila Fernandez, in all honesty. You know, you've done next to nothing for a year, and then you come and beat the player I've said will win the tournament. I felt rather better after she won the title and reminded us why Pam Shriver regards us as the best show in tennis. And if that's the price I have to pay for Leila Fernandez to be back as a factor on a consistent basis, I'm willing to pay it. Not that I have any choice,
I mean,
because I've now
you
had
weren't
to
given
pay
a choice, David. Yeah. But sure, that's very magnanimous of you. Well done.
that's okay, because Fernandez is worth the points hit.
Mm. This week there are all sorts of events happening this week, folks. I'll whiz you through it very quickly. The WTA is in Nanchang. That's a 250 event. They're all 250s on the WTA side. Haddad Maia and Linette, the top two seeds. They're in Cluj-Napoca. Sarana Kisteja and Alicia Parks are the top two seeds, and they're in Monastir. Cluj-Napoca, by the way, is Romania, and Monastir in Tunisia. A real blow for them there that Ons Jabeur has been forced to withdraw once again with a knee injury. Jasmine Paolini and Elisa Mertens, the top two seeds there. The ATP has a 500 event in Tokyo, where we've got Taylor Fritz against Cam Norrie in round one. They've had some great matches in the past, so that's an interesting one. Draper against de Minaur. Draper having qualified. He's been playing challenges, building back up his form. It's good to see. We've got Ruud, Tiafoe, Tommy Paul, Hubert Hurkacz. Felix Auger-Aliassime is on court at the moment. Ben Shelton in the draw. Alexander Zverev was in the draw, but he's already out, having lost to Jordan Thompson. We've also got a 250 on the ATP side in Stockholm with Holger Rune and Adrian Mannarino as the top two seeds. And in Antwerp, where Stefanos Tsitsipas and Jan-Lennard Struff are the top two seeds. Now, we've got some bits and bobs of news items to wrap up that have come to light over the course of the past week. We want to start with the news that the ATP has confirmed the cancellation of the 2023 Tel Aviv Open. That was scheduled to take place from the 5th to the 11th of November. That's been quite obviously cancelled due to security concerns in the region following the outbreak of the war over there. Andrea Gaudenzi said, "The violence and acts of terror witnessed in Israel are beyond comprehension. We strongly condemn any form of terrorism and mourn the loss of innocent lives across this conflict. We hope and pray for peace in the region." And I hope it goes without saying that, you know, we haven't not mentioned it or not been talking about it because we're not very consumed with thoughts and deep, deep sympathy and distress about what's going on in that region. It's just because we're a sports podcast, folks, and this isn't the place for it. In fact, it's a place of refuge for a lot of people going through difficult times. We know we have listeners in that region, whether they're able to listen or not at the moment. I don't know. But we are thinking of everybody in the region and affected by what's going on. Frankly, everyone's affected, aren't they? It's hideous, and it's on our minds. And yeah, we'll continue to be thinking of everybody. Just to stay with tournament news, I suppose. That's a hideous segue, but there we go. Cincinnati is staying in Cincinnati for at least another 25 years. They seem to have gone from we might never see tennis in Cincinnati again to we're going to see tennis in Cincinnati every year for the very much foreseeable future. Their future was very much hanging in the balance. I had heard that it looked odds on that Cincinnati would move elsewhere. But they've announced this week that they are going to be staying at the Linda Van Blee Tennis Centre in Cincinnati. And they did quite a cool little announcement of that, didn't they? They got their two reigning champions, Coco Gauff and Novak Djokovic, to do video messages. And I thought they did quite well with that. I thought it was quite cool.
Yeah, I agree. I thought too that it was likely to move to Charlotte because of the people that own this tournament now, BMOC Capital, who have a stake in that area. And I think it's great that they're staying in Cincinnati personally. It's an established place on the calendar. It's got a history. It's got support. There's too much, really, I think, of not making the most of the historical elements of tennis, and this is one of them. And I love the fact that it's staying, personally.
We had an exclusive Craig Tiley player reveal this week.
It must be time to sell Australian Open tickets.
Yep. Craig Tiley went on Australian telly and, quote, revealed exclusively, his words, folks, not mine, that Rafael Nadal would be returning for the 2024 Australian Open. Nadal himself subsequently tweeting in slight clarification, without clearly wanting to throw Craig Tiley entirely under the bus, quote, I appreciate the vote of confidence from the Australian Open. I'm practicing every day and working hard to come back ASAP. It's an absolute classic of the genre, isn't it, David?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you go back, and I believe our colleague Stu Fraser of The Times did exactly that, to pick out the announcements that Roger Federer, Serena Williams and Andy Murray would all be returning to the tournament in years that very much it was up in the air that they would be able to for various reasons, and they ended up subsequently not returning. And in the case of Nadal, I mean, there's no way that Nadal even knows if he's going to be fit to be playing the Australian Open at this stage. He's back on the practice court, yes. He's hopeful that he can get back out on court at some point next year and have this sort of victory lap or swan song or farewell tour of whatever you want to call it. And maybe more. Maybe his body's going to be okay at a degree that he didn't expect. But it's just not the case that he's definitely playing the Australian Open. Anyway, I get the point. It's an attempt to get people excited for the tournament. I personally think it's not necessary. I think people are excited about the tournament. I think that they announced some things that elevate the event again. There was something to do with a party court or something like that, where they're going to have a restaurant or a bar on the sides of the court, which sounds amazing.
I'm into it, David.
Yeah,
I'm really
absolutely
into it.
And listen, I just
Craig,
don't
focus on the party court. Nobody cares about Nadal.
Listen, I think Craig is a brilliant tournament director in so many ways, and he has been for 20 odd years. I do think he should stop doing these exclusive reveals of players that really are maybe 50-50 at best of playing. But anyway, I just feel like it's an amazing tournament that no longer needs to have any imposter syndrome against the other slams whatsoever. It is their equal. It is in January. We absolutely can't wait. And I suspect tickets are going to fly regardless.
I honestly can't wait. Holger Rune continues to do unexpected things. He potentially maybe might be working with Boris Becker. We're basing this off a photo on social media. He is recently parted company with Patrick Mouratoglou. He does have his other coach, Lars something. Lars, anyone know Lars? He's only ever called Lars. Everyone just says there's Patrick and there's Lars. Anyway, there's a Lars guy. Yeah, he recently stopped working with Patrick Mouratoglou. I thought that was in order to simply focus on working with Lars, but potentially Boris Becker is on the scene. Does anyone care to react to that?
Wasn't what I expected to see. but I, in some ways, Matt, I'm not that surprised now that it's happened.
Right, yeah. It makes sense that Holger Rune would make quite a dramatic coaching choice, which, you know, I think Boris Becker would definitely fall into that category, especially at the moment. They seem to be in Monte Carlo, Monaco, I think, which is where Holger Rune does a lot of his training. Yeah, it's very much a watch this space.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully the first bit of coaching he does is to say, stop playing, Holger. You're injured and you need to rest. But who knows? Last bit of news from the week. The teams have been announced for the Billie Jean King Cup final. Seven of the world's top 20, including Elena Rybakina, Marketa Vondroušová, Karolina Muchovic, Caroline Garcia, Belinda Bencic and Madison Keys. But that is a good lineup. There are great players in there. But there are notable absentees. No Iga Świątek for Poland, again. No Coco Gauff or Jessica Pegula for the USA. It's such a blow, isn't it? It's not unexpected. It's entirely understandable, given the schedule, given tennis's propensity to eat itself, which this is an absolutely classic example. But what are we doing that two of the biggest events in women's tennis are positioned such that the best players cannot realistically compete in both? What are we doing? We know that those players would want to if it were possible without potentially putting their health and fitness at risk. We know that all those players would want to. This is just one of those bloody hell tennis, what are we doing moments, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I will not forget Coco Gauff and Jessica Pegula just hitting the wall a year ago, trying to play them both. And just they're playing the doubles as well in WTA finals, just not winning a set, I don't think. And there has to be a cutoff point for everybody. And there has to be just a common sense element. And I realise it's the typical, well, it's not all run by the one body. So... And I know there's a lot of other factors, and there's the money and there's the China holdout leading to needing more money. And where do you put the finals? And now Saudi Arabia and all the rest of it. But it just makes you despair, because these are two great events and they're just ruining each other. I mean, it's the Billie Jean King Cup finals that is coming off worse, because it's the second one in the row. But it's just a bummer.
Yep, it is a bummer. In not bummer news, though, it is the W100 event in Shrewsbury this week. Note the adjusted pronunciation. I've been corrected far and wide.
Hang on a minute.
I know. I was trying to sneak that in there. I know. Blame my parents. They've been
really
saying it wrong.
Okay.
Locals still disagree, apparently.
Oh, do they? Okay, that makes me feel a bit better.
Yeah, I'm told.
So it's actually a free-for-all and anything goes.
Dave Cortine, who runs the event, who's a listener of ours, tells me that people there disagree.
Oh, okay, I'll stick with Shrewsbury then.
So we'll find out.
I had
out.
Some extremely militant people telling me I'd got it wrong. Anyway, the event is happening this week. Harriet Dart, Victoria Golubic and future Wimbledon champion Yulia Niemeyer all in the draw. And I know I say that facetiously, but let's remember that Shrewsbury is famous. This event is famous for incubating future Wimbledon champions, because who is their defending champion? Current Wimbledon champion, Markéta Vondroušová. So they're all in the field, as are the tennis podcast. We're going to be there on Wednesday. We're going to be doing a live show. Are tickets still available, David?
Yes, there are a few. Yeah, not many.
not many, folks. But tickets are available. We'll pop the link in our show notes if you would like to come. We have a winner of our Billie Jean King Cup competition. The winner is, and they are winning, tickets to the Billie Jean King Cup by Gainbridge finals, the semi-finals of the finals. That's nice and clear. I've done well there, haven't I? Plus accommodation and flights from an EU or UK airport is, and wait for this name, folks, the winner is Penny Powers. Penny is based in Canada, but spends a lot of time in Europe running flyingmax.com. And there are all sorts of incredible pictures of Penny paragliding on there. And I've been perusing those pictures this morning, and they are, as advertised, incredible pictures. Penny says that as she read through our email to say she'd won, she kept saying to her husband, "You won't believe it. You won't believe it." He was worried something terrible had happened and made me read it to him without interrupting it with, "You won't believe it." Penny says she discovered us on a 10-hour drive to northern British Columbia, where her son was playing ice hockey. These North Americans in their driving. She says she needed something other than music to get her through the long drives. The archive has helped her through many a long drive and time in the gym. And her husband often wonders what she's giggling about. Her favourite players of the past were Chrissy Evert and Steffi Graf. More recently, Aryna Sabalenka and Ons Jabeur. And she's hoping that her 85-year-old mum will join her in Seville. How lovely is that? Penny thinks the last time they watched a professional tennis match together was when her mum and dad took the family to watch Vitas Gerulaitis against Bernie Mitten in South Africa. Penny says, "My poor husband Max is the backup plan. If my mum can't come, Max will join me and will gladly take the spot. He too, though, would love to see my mum and I able to enjoy the tennis together, as she was the one who got me into tennis as a young kid." That's so lovely, Penny. And if you would like to go, not necessarily with Penny, but sort of adjacent to Penny, to the Billie Jean King Cup finals in Seville in November, tickets are available now, and the link to book is available in the show notes to this podcast. And this podcast has a mascot, and it is a returning mascot, and it is Mocha. Mocha is a now 3-year-old chocolate Labrador. She was born July 2020. This is her third year running as a pet mascot in some form or fashion. And her passion for tennis and tennis balls have only grown with that time. Although she doesn't know it, most of her walks are accompanied by me listening to the pod. And we have a lovely picture of Mocha here, and that will be going in our newsletter. We love a returning mascot, don't we? And we think Mocha is one of two three-peats. I think we had another one earlier in the year.
I think so,
and I,
too.
At the time, yes, posited that they were the only one, but enter Mocha onto the scene to say, hey now. Mocha, you're lovely. Thank you very much to you and to Ryan Riley, your owner. We have our mascots, of course. David has Maisie. We've discussed how they performed this week. Amazing. I've got Xenia. I thought I'd play it safe this week and go with Carlos Alcaraz. Matt has Darwin. Do you go for Nicholas Jarry, Matt?
No, I didn't, actually. I went for someone else who lost.
Right.
Who's that?
Kasatkina, who got absolutely taken apart by Krejcikova. So my form continues.
Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have Jamie, Hannah and Drew. Hello to you. They are our top folks and executive producers. And we have shout outs, Matt.
Yes, and we start with Sean Bartell, who is in Washington, D.C., but fittingly for this episode, grew up in Cincinnati and said that the best moment of every summer was the Masters event there, which he would attend with his parents and see all the world's best players.
Oh, like Mona Bartell.
Yes.
The German player.
Yes.
Well done, Catherine. Yeah. That's
Thank
good.
You very much. Sure. I once had to approach her and ask her for a press time while she was sobbing into a towel.
Oh, dear.
She was very polite. Thank you, Sean.
Cheers, Sean.
We've also got Sophia Binders, who is from Hungary but living in Munich.
Hello, Sophia. Like Sophia Kennan.
Yeah.
Is your name also secretly Sonia? Sophia. Well, not so secretly. Who can say?
Actually, this Sophia's name starts with a Z, which I've taken to be silent, but maybe it's Zophia.
Okay.
You've taken it upon yourself to designate that a silent Z.
Well, I have to do something, don't I? I have to either pronounce it or not pronounce it.
Let us know, Sophia. Thank you for your support.
And finally,
or Sophia.
Who can say? And finally, we've got Courtney Finlayson, who is in Illinois.
Right,
hello, Courtney.
And Courtney says, while there may not be too many tennis Courtneys, my mum's cousin was the professional player Laura Dupont. She passed away about 20 years ago, but her mother, my mum's aunt, lived until 107 years old.
Whoa.
That's so cool.
So
like Antoine connection. Dupont. Dupont.
Yes.
Is that his name?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's out.
Right, yeah. He was barely in. Now he's out.
He's had a tough year.
Thank you very much, Courtney. Like Courtney Walsh, our Australian colleague and sometime tennis opponent of Matt Roberts.
Who's
a lot better than I am.
Yeah.
The joke among the media is that whoever plays with Courtney wins because he's just better than everyone.
He hasn't played me yet.
Courtney, thank you ever so much. We'll be back next Monday to talk about everything that has happened in tennis in the intervening period. And one of those things that will have happened is us going to Shrewsbury. I'm returning to the motherland, folks. I've got big plans, Matt, to do a drive-by of the my first ever home.
Ooh,
in
fun.
Wrighton, Shropshire. It's sort of on the way. So we can drive past Sandy Way.
And we'll have cameraman Matthew asleep in the back because he said he sleeps on road trips.
Yeah, he says he simply can't avoid sleeping on road trips. Matthew, that means you have absolutely no say on what comes out of the speakers. Those are the rules. So we'll be in Shrewsbury on Wednesday. Do come and join us if you'd like to. Link to get tickets is in the show notes, as is the link to get tickets to the Billie Jean King Cup finals. All sorts of other fun stuff in there as well, and in the newsletter. We'll be back on Monday.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.